This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to The People Speak. I am Sophia Ray, your host for this week. Tune in every Tuesday at 9 p.m. Eastern. You may listen into the show by telephone in the U.S. at 716-748-0144, or by logging in by computer or tablet at bbsradio.com. Click on the listen icon and navigate to Station 2. Listeners can participate during the show by calling in their questions for the guest toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 1-888-429-5471. Tonight our guest is Travis Walton, the author of the book Fire in the Sky, written in 1978. His encounter inspired the movie Fire in the Sky that came into the big screen in 1993. On November 5th, in 1975, Mr. Walton was working as a logger in the Apache National Forest in Arizona. On his way home with his colleagues, they saw what they described as a fire in the sky. To their surprise, they realized they had encountered an extraterrestrial craft. Tonight, he is here to share with us his experience from that dreadful night that forever changed his life and his family's life. It's a pleasure and honor to welcome Travis Walton to The People Speak. Good evening, Travis. How are you tonight?
Good evening, Sophia. I'm doing fine.
Great. I'm happy to hear. Thank you for joining us tonight. It's great to have you on.
Good to be here.
So you have the book and the movie. Start with the book. How was the experience for you to writing this book after the whole experience of this phenomena that you went through?
Well, you know, it's kind of a crash course in writing. It was something I'd never undertaken before, so I had to really learn the ropes about, you know, how these sorts of things are done, and it's quite an education.
Absolutely, and quite an education for us as well. Are you comfortable explaining that dreadful night to us all here tonight?
Pardon?
Are you comfortable explaining to our viewers on your firsthand account to that night of November 5th, 1975?
Well, you know, it's even after talking about it for over 38 years, it's still nothing that's comfortable, but it's a lot easier than it used to be, that's for sure. It was just an ordinary work day, and we were headed home, and we saw this glow coming through the trees. It, you know, nothing alarming at first, but definitely out of place in the woods. So, you know, we thought campers or hunters, maybe a forest fire, a crash plane. We were going through all the possibilities, but, you know, not with a whole lot of anxiety at first, but it just wasn't adding up because the light was coming from higher than where you would estimate the crest of the ridge would be.
And from what I understand, this light, it seemed to be like a glowing fire. Was it the color of fire?
Well, you know, fire can be anything from, you know, a white light to an orange light, you know. And in the movie, they made it look very orange, but it was actually, you know, kind of a pale golden color.
Okay. Yeah, a pale golden color. That is very interesting. And when you reached the craft and when you came upon it, was it glowing different colors?
Oh, no, just that golden color. It was sort of a yellowish, milky, sort of a soft glow. Not so bright that you couldn't see, you know, clearly define the dimensions of the craft. It was metallic in areas that weren't glowing, but the whole surface was, you know, just as smooth as glass, whether it was the non-glowing metal parts or the glowing areas.
And how big was the craft? Was it fairly a good size, or was it fairly small?
It wasn't all that huge, but, you know, it's definitely, you know, something that was very imposing, you know, in a natural environment where there's nothing but dirt, rocks, trees, and plants and things, you know, to see this powerful machine. Plus, you know, the sound it was making was so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as we saw it, you know, one of the guys in the back, one of the crew members, yelled out, "It's a flying saucer." I mean, it was just so unmistakable. You know, skeptics that tried to say we were really just seeing the planet Jupiter, it's just so laughable. This was less than 100 feet away. There was just no mistaking that this thing hovering there was, you know, some very powerful and very non-human-looking machine.
I have to say, I watched in 93, when the movie came out, I went to the movie theaters and I saw the movie. I actually saw the movie twice in the theaters. I was amazed. I was appalled to the whole movie. But in the movie, the character that played your role, he just seemed really fearless to the craft. Were you feeling fearless towards the craft when you had approached it and went underneath it?
Well, I was probably trying to appear that way to the rest of the crew, but, you know, I was probably as scared, no, probably more scared than they were, because I was getting closer to it. And, you know, the closer I got, the more anxious they got, and they were yelling and cussing at me to get away from there and get back in the truck. And I really didn't understand the danger I was getting myself into. I really thought it would take off before I got much closer. But when I got up there and I was looking up at it, like about a 45, it suddenly got louder and started to move. And so I was already, you know, just real, real nervous about what I was doing. So I just jumped into a crouch. And the nearest cover was a log that was sticking up out of this pile of debris that was there. And I got down behind that log and decided to run back to the truck. But when I stood up, wham, that's when it hit me. And it was just a real powerful jolt, kind of like a physical blow and kind of like an electric shock. But the guys in the truck said that they could hear it, that it sounded like high voltage, that there was like a crack or a popping or some sort of an electrical sound. It sent me flying through the air. You know, some of the crewmen said 10 feet, some said 20, but, you know, they could tell by how I was just so limp and not protecting myself in the fall that they immediately just concluded that it had killed me. It was that violent. Now, the movie kind of plays that down, and, mm-hmm. you know, just from seeing what's in the movie, you wouldn't assume anybody got killed, but, you know, it's really surprising that Hollywood would not, you know, at least embellish that rather than play it down, but it was far more violent than that.
Absolutely. I would imagine so. You know, when you said that the shock, was it a beam of light that came unto you from above and it just shot down on
you? Yeah, and, you know, in hindsight, you know, it seems that there was some kind of an energy that was building up in this craft, You know, and I've even speculated, you know, because of what was discovered later, that the trees nearest where it came down had developed this rapid growth that continued for, you know, decades after that incident, that perhaps they were doing something there. It was either a side effect of the presence of the craft, or maybe they were actually deliberately doing some kind of agricultural experiment. But follow-up research has really uncovered some fascinating stuff with the alteration and the growth of those trees. But that energy was so violent that when the crewmen, you know, as soon as they saw that, they figured that they were next and that they were going to be killed. So they took off and drove the truck, just a mad dash through the woods that almost destroyed the truck. But they said when they were returning, one of the men said he wasn't as scared that the craft was still lurking nearby because they'd seen it take off. His greatest fear was what my body was going to look like, because, you know, they were arguing about whether it had burned me up or disintegrated me or whatever. But, you know, they were all sure it killed me because it was that powerful.
I could only imagine what the colleagues were, you know, going through and experiencing. Well, opposed to yourself, you're the one that went through the traumatic experience. But they did too, but not as you did. That is just, it's profound. It's really hard to wrap our heads around it almost.
And you know, having experienced that, it's something none of the seven of us have really fully been able to wrap our heads around. You know, in the last, you know, 28 years, there's been dozens of documentaries done, but there was one done recently by the Sci-Fi Channel called Paranormal Witness. Now, it's normally a one-hour show, but they did 90 minutes just on this case, and they interviewed everybody involved, but they got a lot of the crewmen that had never wanted to do any interviews. And it really, after all those years, you can see the profound effect it had on their lives, you know. You know, just the confronting something from another world, and the threat of you know, being put in prison for murder, and it's still something that just really rocked us all to the core.
I couldn't imagine being in that position, watching a loved one, friend, going through that experience, and myself being helpless to helping you, and being in fear and shock. And did they have to go through any you know, counseling or therapy?
Well, you know, there just wasn't anything available back then, so you know, the residual effects have stayed with all of us, you know, to this day. We were kind of on our own in finding a way to cope with all this. And it wasn't made any easier by the constant accusations. At first, the men were accused of murder, and that was, you know, pretty serious, because not only was law enforcement threatening them, but my brothers were threatening them. If it was determined that they had done me any harm, that, you know, they were under a lot of pressure. And at the same time, you're trying to explain this most incredible event, and then you're getting all this blowback. It was really hard on all of us. But when the sheriff brought in the top lie detector expert, you know, in the state, and tested them, and when they passed, you know, people still just didn't want to accept this, you know. So they tried to explain it away 100 different ways. But Dr. Harder, he performed the regressive hypnosis on me. Mm-hmm. And he said that if you had six people come forward and testify that they had, you know, seen me commit a murder, it would have been no problem. Everybody would consider that conclusive evidence that what they were saying actually happened. But then when they report a UFO sighting, the same six witnesses, oh, well, maybe this, blah, 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 and that's without lie detector tests. But at the time, the president of the American Polygraph Association said that when you have six people passing tests on the same issue, the odds would be 1,000,000 to 1 of there being any kind of a mistake. Because, you know, one person taking a test is almost 100%, but when you have six people, that just puts it. And that was back then. Now there's been 16 passed tests in connection with this. I've passed five of them from three different examiners, very super high qualified examiners, all of them with many years of law enforcement experience.
Interesting. Wow. Were you taken into the craft?
Yeah. That's where I woke up. When I woke up, I was on board. I didn't know that at first. I was just in a lot of pain and struggling to breathe. It just seemed like I was suffocating. And, you know, eventually I remembered what happened in the woods, you know, approaching the craft. And I just thought that somehow when I went to run away, I'd hit my head or fallen or something. I'd gotten hurt. And, you know, here I was waking up in a hospital. And I could hear the sounds of doctors, you know, medical personnel moving around me, and they had this thing across my chest, and I was dizzy and disoriented. And when I'd open my eyes, you know, I had like double vision. It was all blurry, so, you know, that increased the dizziness, so I'd just close my eyes again. But I didn't come to real quickly. It was kind of in and out for a while. But when I finally got a little more clarity, and I looked to see to my right, there was this creature standing over me, looking at me, and I just flipped out.
How scary!
It was so close, and such a shock to see it up close, and to very suddenly realize I was not in a hospital. I immediately started screaming like a madman, and as soon as I saw it, I just reflexively flung my arm out to push it away, and I was so weak that it was really hard to even move my arm, but in spite of that, it seemed a lot lighter and softer than I expected, but I was kind of recoiling, just rolling away from it at the same time. And this thing they had across my chest fell off on the floor, but I was just, you know, having a lot of trouble standing up. I was dizzy and weak, and they were coming towards me, and I was just kind of riveted on their eyes. And I was backing away and screaming. I bumped up against a shelf, and I looked to see what I'd run into, and there were a bunch of instruments laid out there. I just grabbed the biggest thing. It was a long, clear rod-looking thing, and I started just immediately swinging it through the air with a threatening motion. They weren't close enough to hit, but I was making striking motions, and then I tried to hit it on the table, because it looked like glass, but it wouldn't break. And so I just kept swinging and screaming, and they stopped out of range. But when they stopped and stared at me like that, it just gave me this real excruciating feeling. And here a while back, I had the opportunity doing some filming for the new movie, 701 the Movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's a collection of UFO cases, important cases, and these school kids from Zimbabwe, you know, there was like 60 kids out on recess, and this craft came down in the middle of the day, and these beings got out and came up to the kids, and they said they were being interviewed the same day I was, and they were telling me I was interested to find out if when they stared at them, if it gave them that painful feeling that I was feeling. And they said no, that somehow the message that they were getting was coming through that stare, but it wasn't painful like it was for me. And so I'm thinking that what happened there was when I raised up under that craft, that I closed the distance between me and the ground, I mean the craft and the ground, and actually, you know, provided a jump gap for the spark to go to the ground through me, and that I was injured by that. You know, for a long time I used to think that it might have been some kind of a defensive weapon or maybe a deliberate attempt to stun me. But I'm thinking that now that more likely it was just an accident, and then they were kind of in a situation where if they didn't bring me aboard to revive me, that, you know, I would have been dead.
So, oh, that's interesting.
So now I'm thinking more of an ambulance call than an abduction. But
can you recall how many beings there were?
Well, there was three of them standing around me. I'm thinking that they were trying to keep control of me, and that it wasn't working because that energy passing through my head disrupted the neurons, the brain waves, in a way that prevented them from controlling me. And the reason I'm thinking that is because after I was returned, they did a battery of medical tests, and one of those was an EEG. And this is probably one of the best places in the world to have an EEG, was Barrow's Neurological Institute. That's a brain trauma center that's world famous, and it was also especially valuable test because the technician was not told who I was or that I was connected with this UFO incident, because the media attention was just so out of, it was just insane. So it was kind of an assumed name to keep the babble rabble from getting out of hand. But that provided, you know, kind of a double blind situation where he was just looking for some signs of injury, and he did, in his report, describe an odd brainwave pattern, which supports the idea that maybe the reason I was able to get off that table and they weren't able to control me, and that stare was so uncomfortable. I mean, you know, that was the focus of my nightmares for months after that, is that stare and those eyes just boring into me in this real invasive, intrusive sort of feeling.
I can imagine what our listeners are asking right now. I'm sure they want to know what they look like. Can you give us a description?
Well, they were very short, small. And, you know, people say, well, why are you so afraid? They're small, you know. But, you know, in a situation where you're already, you know, in a panic situation just because of the shortage of oxygen. Now, I don't know whether that was due to the injury of the beam hitting me in the chest, or if the atmosphere inside there wasn't exactly right for humans. But whatever it was, I was already sort of pre-primed for fear, and then seeing them, you know, in conjunction with this pain, just triggered an out-of-control fear reaction.
When I saw the movie in the movie theater, I remember the scene where they showed you in the craft, and I remember, like, I film, they covered your body as a blanket in the film. Did that happen?
No, you know, that's one, they did so much fictionalization changing from what really happened, but that was actually something a change that helped communicate that feeling of suffocation better than if they just showed the actor breathing hard and looking, you know, panicked. You wouldn't really get the connection that it was this feeling of suffocation that was adding to the panic. So they put the membrane over the actor's face, and he's struggling to scream through it, struggling to breathe through it. And I think that does a better job of communicating to the audience the source of this out-of-control fear that I had. Because, you know, some people think, well, I would just stay calm and ask good questions, try to pocket a souvenir, you know, get real, you know.
Absolutely, get real.
I mean, this isn't science fiction. This was me waking up in a situation that was just unlike anything I'd ever encountered in my entire life, even in watching, you know, TV or movies.
Before this experience, did you ever have any special abilities or spiritual experiences like telepathy or remote viewing or any heightened sensitivities before this? Or how about you, after, did you experience any telepathy or such?
Well, I've always kind of avoided that subject because I really never wanted to be the subject of study, you know, the bug in the jar. But yeah, there were some interesting things that developed.
I can imagine, yeah. Wow. I mean, so profound, this experience, and enlightening everybody to that we are not alone. I do not believe that we are alone, and it is a very controversial subject when we speak about extraterrestrials and other species out here with us. It's still today a very sensitive subject.
It is, and you know, it really shouldn't be. Because, you know, it's almost being like a flat earther. You know, in today's world, where we understand the universe that we live in, you know, back when this happened, they didn't know of a single planet going around another star other than our sun. You know, astronomers figured that other stars probably had planets, but they had no actual evidence of it. So they had this thing called the Drake Equation, which was going to calculate the number of stars that would have planets. But now, last year, NASA said it's a virtual certainty that every star has about a dozen planets. And, you know, with billions, 20 billion stars just in the Milky Way galaxy, our galaxy, that's the near neighborhood, you know, that puts the number of possible life-supporting planets in the billions. And, you know, it's just foolish for people to assume that we would be the only planet that would have life. If they understand anything about the conditions that allow for life, the temperature, the presence of water, you know, you know, skeptics are fond of saying that, well, if there was any aliens, they wouldn't have two arms and two legs. They would, you know, just be a ball of plasma or, you know, some bizarre shape. But the truth is, you know, that and I predict, mark my words, one day this will be borne out, that we're not going to be astounded by how bizarre other life forms are. And I'm not talking just about the intelligent beings on the planet. You know, anything from the plants or the animals in the water or whatever, they're going to be a startlingly, amazingly Earth-like rather than bizarre or something unrecognizable. And that's because there's just a basic law of biology that the environment shapes the organism. And the only conditions that allow for life are the same kinds of conditions that are going to shape it to be something more familiar. Everything that winds up living in the sea comes to take on a very fish-like form, even if it's a mammal or a bird or an amphibian, a reptile. They all, you know, develop the characteristics that allow them to, you know, propel themselves through the water and like that. And there's all kinds of examples with earth life forms that even animals that are completely, completely unrelated come to look very much like each other if they or have a similar environment. They can be widely separated, but if they, you know, like in a nocturnal forest-dwelling critter, you know, you have a flying squirrel in the United States, and in Australia they have something called a sugar glider that looks a whole lot like a flying squirrel because it lives in the night in the trees, and it comes to look that way. So even amongst these alien species, they're going to look a lot alike, and some of them will look a lot like us without having any direct, you know, hereditary connection. I think that even a lot of what's reported as grays, and, you know, the beings I encountered, people say, well, they were grays, but I think there's quite a variety there that are getting lumped into one category just because they're large-eyed, hairless, you know, pale-looking creatures, and they could come from a variety of different planets.
I don't mean to cut you off, Travis. This is Sophia Ray, and you are tuned into The People Speak with our guest, Travis Walton. Right now, we have to cut into a break, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Got questions? The library's got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
With over 150 million registered users, PalTalk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 PalTalk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining PalTalk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive, but there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to VBS
Radio.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you. Me.
We're back. This is your host, Sophia Ray, and we are with our guest, Travis Walton, and we are discussing his experience from November 5th, 1975, with his encounter with extraterrestrials. Welcome back, Travis.
Yeah, it's quite an experience, you know, living through all that back then. In some ways, it seems like yesterday.
Thank you for sharing with us your experience firsthand. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's been quite a battle over the years, you know. I've taken every single accusation that the skeptics have made or alternative explanations that were suggested and, you know, very carefully documented why these kinds of things you know, it makes no sense to try to explain it away using these kinds of ideas because it's just full of holes. You know, for instance, the idea that I'd had a transitory psychosis and temporarily went insane and believed that I had this experience, but you know, that would explain why I passed lie detector tests because I believed it was true, but I was just crazy, you know, for briefly and then became sane again. Well, you know, I had a whole battery of psychiatric tests that proved to be totally normal in the whole testing. But what this theory and several others never took into consideration is how would seven people have the same delusion? That just doesn't happen, you know? They were trying to say that maybe the hypnotist planted these memories in my mind, but, you know, I remembered everything before I was hypnotized. I just couldn't talk about it because it was so traumatizing that I just break down. So, you know, there was no leading questions or anything. There was many observers to the hypnosis. And on top of that, the rest of the crew wasn't hypnotized. So, you know, how did they see what I saw?
Right. Travis, I don't want to cut you off, but we have a caller on the line. We have Mike from California. Mike, you are on air with us. Go ahead.
I believe you were abducted by extraterrestrials. You don't have to prove it to me anymore. And the thing is, though, my question is, if there are extraterrestrials and, you know, just they are aliens, they are not like us. That much I get from your experience. Is there any chance you think that they would be open to actually publicly revealing themselves and actually helping us rather than studying us like lab animals? That's the impression I got from your encounter.
I've developed a theory about that. And, you know, skeptics are fond of saying, well, why don't they just land on the White House lawn and say, here we are? And, you know, there's this thing in science fiction called the non-interference directive or the prime directive, you know, where, you know, the idea of these extremely advanced cultures making contact with the lesser developed, and that being us, would be extremely destructive. And you can see how, you know, in the early days of explorers, you know, getting on a ship and going over and making contact with relatively primitive people, that it was almost always extremely destructive to the less developed culture. And so on the other end of the scale, recently physicist Michio Kaku was saying, you know, people keep envisioning these possible alien cultures as being maybe a few hundred years ahead of us. He said, but based on the age of these star systems, they could be hundreds of thousands or millions of years ahead of us. And Arthur C. Clarke gives the example. He says, a sufficiently advanced technology would be indistinguishable from magic to us. And so, you know, I go with the opposite extreme of them landing on the White House lawn or making open contact. I say that with that kind of technology, they would be capable of carrying out everything that they want to do here on this planet and remain completely undetected. So between those two extremes of being undetected and making open contact, why do we have this little glimpses, little almost peekaboo sorts of, you know, sort of provable but not so so overwhelmingly, you know, definitive that it causes that kind of disruption. If we had that kind of open contact, half the world wouldn't go to work the next day. And it would have extreme disruption in our societies. So I think what's going on is a kind of a conditioning that we're just being sort of gradually educated, you know, just a gradual sort of get used to the idea.
Travis, that brings me to my next question. Conditioned for what? I mean, I feel like we're at a point where we need help. I don't think the human species can pull out of what's happening right now with all the technology out of control, the weapons of mass destruction.
But remember,
I think we need help.
It's destructive for them to infuse technology. We don't, you know, our problems are not due to a deficiency of technology. It's due to a deficiency of wisdom. And that's up to us to gain for ourselves. And, you know, the conditioning is get used to the idea that, you know, one day we will be on that threshold where we can develop the ability to travel out there. And it's probably in their interest that we have a little more common sense and you know, better conduct ourselves once we get out there.
Well, you know, I'm hoping that at some point they do intervene if we're going to destroy ourselves. Otherwise, you know, what's the alternative? We just destroy ourselves.
Yeah, well, it's all comes down to choices, you know. Just time and time and time again, I look around and I see that most of the problems, that even on a local personal scale, most of the problems people have are of their own making.
I agree.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, by the way, are you speaking anywhere or appearing anywhere?
Yes, I'm speaking in Rio Rancho outside of Albuquerque on October 4th. And also coming up on November 5th, I'm having the first annual conference. I'm hosting speakers from around the country, international speakers, and you can find out more about it at www.skyfiresummit.com. It's going to be, quite a unique event. This is the first time ever, and we're going to conduct a skywatch on the exact site at the exact time of the incident, 39 years to the day.
Can you repeat those dates again, please?
Skyfiresummit.com.
And what dates are there?
The anniversary is on November 5th, but the conference itself is going to be 7th, 8th, and 9th on the weekend. But it's just too important to miss that fifth date, even though it falls in the middle of the week. So we're having an early exclusive Skywatch to where we go directly to the site at the exact time and place that it happened. It was even on a Wednesday, like it is this year, back when it happened originally.
Interesting. Wow. I'm curious, have you had any other encounters since that day?
Well, you know, when I was returned, it was already worldwide news. And if I'd have known what I was in for, I'd have tried to keep quiet. As a matter of fact, I did try to not do interviews. I just wasn't up to it. It was no fun to talk about. But, you know, then, you know, people acted like, well, he's got something to hide if he's not, if he's refusing interviews. And then as soon as I agreed to do interviews, then I'm a publicity seeker. So I was damned if I do and damned if I don't. But so, you know, I resolved that if anything more were to happen, I just wouldn't tell anybody.
I don't blame you. I don't blame you one bit with everybody, you know. The human race is very ignorant when it comes to this subject and very just unwilling to accept. We don't want to accept that there are other species other than the animals on Earth and ourselves. So when we come into this whole extraterrestrial alien thought, people make claims to such as there's a false alien agenda. What do you think, or what do you say to those people who claim that there is a false alien agenda?
Well, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff. You always have to come down to this. You have to ask these people the one crucial question, again and again throughout their narrative. How do you know this? You know, it's not out of place for people to demand some evidence and some proof. And, you know, in my case, I've, you know, gathered everything I could to back up what I'm saying. But you can't just expect people to just take your word for it, you know. Sometimes people have delusions or they make up stories or whatever. So, you know, the skeptics are fond of saying extraordinary claims demand extraordinary evidence, and I kind of agree with that. But that doesn't mean just because you can't prove it that it didn't happen. And that's the error that the skeptics make, you know, that the unproven is therefore disproven. And that's not the case at all.
How long do you recall being in their captivity? Was it quite a while? Was it many days?
Yeah, it was 5 days and 6 hours altogether. And I didn't have memory of all of that when I was returned. There was a hypnotic block that the hypnotist, you know, felt that there was some sort of a threat not to go beyond that. And whether that's just to hide those memories from me or another theory that was developed in the last couple of years is the possibility that if you were to regress someone back in time and through a period of time and during which they were in cardiac arrest, that you could actually cause them to be in cardiac arrest. And then how are you going to reach them to get them out of cardiac arrest if they're unconscious all of a sudden? So, you know, you could go beyond the point of retrieval. And, you know, when I was hit by that beam, you know, it could have been at least cardiac arrest or something even more fatal.
I imagine it being something like being electrocuted by a socket or something. I can just imagine the being paralyzed, and just the only thing that is moving are your thoughts.
Yeah, well, it's I guess you could call that a near-death experience, or maybe even a death experience, actually.
Absolutely, because you haven't been the same since, correct?
That's true.
How did your family handle this?
Well, you know, my friends and family, you know, they're the ones that have been the most trusting and the most believing. It's only people who knew very little about me are the most distrustful and disbelieving. And the less they know, you know, the skeptics were so vaguely informed that they didn't even know what kind of vehicle we're in or any of the details, and they start throwing out theory to try to attack it and explain it away. So the less people know, the more they think they know.
I have a question coming in from Mike in California. Travis, has the abduction left any residual effects like reoccurring nightmares, perhaps dream encounters, or perhaps even other abductions? And has it heightened your awareness of what humans are in their place in the universe?
Well, that was about four or five questions, but yeah, to most of them, you know, it was definitely something that caused a lot of intense nightmares for quite a while afterwards. And I guess today, I don't think they had the terminology back then of post-traumatic stress syndrome, but or whatever, the disorder, I guess is what they call it. But, you know, back in the day, they called it shell-shocked, or they had other words for it. But I was definitely extremely traumatized.
Patty in Florida is asking, was Travis a paid tech advisor on Fire in the Sky, the film, and what was his biggest criticism of the movie in relation to what actually happened?
Well, you know, I was an advisor to the script writer and provided a lot of details, but at the same time, when the studio got involved and decided to fictionalize certain aspects of it, they certainly did it over my objections. And I almost got myself barred from the set complaining about some of these things, but I think they took it too far in certain areas. Like, the part aboard the craft is where they took the greatest liberty, and I would think that the public, that's the thing that they would want to know the most about.
Absolutely.
So I'm trying to get a remake of the movie. You know, I've been collecting emails from people that spontaneously just have, you know, expressed the desire that there would be a more accurate remake. And one day I'll take all those emails in one package and present them to the studio and, you know, demonstrate that there's a huge interest out here.
Good idea.
For people that want to see what really happened.
We, throughout the media and throughout just, you know, the grapevine, all over the internet and such forth, there has been some rumors about our government working secretly with ETs. Do you think that's possible? Or do you feel like that our government does have connection and relationships with extraterrestrials?
Well, I certainly think they know a lot more than they're telling. And there has been a kind of a dual purpose. On the one hand, it's sort of, you know, the whole field of UFOs and sightings and all that serves to cover up for a lot of secret military projects. So it provides cover for them that way. But at the same time, I think there's been a sort of a suppression and a disinformation campaign going at the same time.
If there is something that you want our listeners to know, what would that be? Just in awareness of their presence or just your feelings, anything. If there's something, what would you like us to know?
Well, you know, in my case, you know, especially the way Fire in the Sky represented it, you know, it was all horror, all negative. And that was accurate for how I felt at the time, you know. People left the theaters with the emotional impact that the incident had on me at that time. But, you know, it's only after decades of mulling over what happened that I come to conclude that it was more about taking me aboard to revive me than just taking me aboard to do experiments or something. So, you know, I'd say people need to be a lot more open to the idea that of benign intentions here. There's a number of researchers who think that even people who report basically negative experiences are really just misinterpreting what's going on, that some of these things are done for their own good. Some people come back and report that long-standing medical problems have been resolved, and other kinds of benefits that they didn't, you know, really realize were there, but at the same time, they were feeling very traumatized.
There's a formal prime minister, I believe it is, in Canada, who is claiming that extraterrestrials are actually here helping us. Do you think that's true?
I think in my case that, you know, the only personal evidence I have is that they are benevolent, or at least not malevolent. You know, in some ways they might be indifferent to things that, you know, we consider important, but I think with an extremely advanced culture that their moral and ethical development will somewhat keep pace with other kinds of development over time.
Travis, we are out of time. I am so sorry to cut you off, but we are out of time. I just want to let our viewers just remind them of the conference, the 2014 New Mexico UFO Conference on October 4th, 2014. This conference is in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Travis Walton will be there personally. Thank you all for listening to the people speak tonight. I want to thank our engineer, Don Newsom. And please, please tune in to the people speak next week with our guest, Edward Peck, a retired U.S. ambassador. You can also go to Travis Walton's site at www.traviswalton.com. Travis, thank you again so much for being here. I'm so sorry that we are out of time. I would love to spend more time with you and talk more with you. It was great, and thank you so much.
Well, good night to everyone.
Good night.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief of us, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.